Welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Speck. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Gary Bubel, Vice President and Projects Director of BP Exploration Alaska, speaks on international mega pipeline projects, transportation system, or political lever. For the past 28 years, first with ARCO Oil and Gas in Texas, and now BP, Gary Bubel has managed major pipeline projects all over the world, including the Gulf of Mexico, offshore China, Indonesia, and Alaska. He has visited over 40 countries, set foot on six continents, and lived in Russia for 8.5 years. He moved to Moscow in 1998 as the General Project Manager for the Caspian Pipeline Consortium, or CPC project, where he managed the design, construction, and commissioning of a 935-mile crude oil export system from western Kazakhstan across southern Russia to the Black Sea. In 2003, Bubel returned to Texas, where he was responsible for the completion of the Mardi Gras transportation system in the deepwater Gulf of Mexico, another major oil and gas pipeline system. Gary Bubel arrived in Alaska in 2007 with his wife and four children. As the Vice President and Projects Director for BP, today Bubel manages BP's Alaska North Slope Renewal Program. On September 19, 2008, he spoke at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on international mega pipeline projects, transportation system, or political lever. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents Gary Bubel.
It's a pleasure to be here and talk to you about large international pipeline projects. And I've had the privilege of working on two very, very large projects. And I'm going to talk to you a bit about one of those today, and also just some things that are of interest and common association with these projects. Some of you may have been here thinking I was going to talk about the Alaska Gas Pipeline, and I may touch on it briefly, but that wasn't the purpose of the talk. You can draw your own analogies to what I will talk about and how it applies to an Alaska gas pipeline. And you'll see some associations and some implications for that, but I'm not going to talk specifically about it. BP, the company I work for, actually has a long history with large projects like this. From the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which most of you are familiar with, to the CATS system, Central Area Transit System in the North Sea, the Ocensa Pipeline in Colombia, and in more recent times, the BTC, Baku-Tbilisi-Jehan Pipeline in Central Asia, the Caspian Pipeline in Russia, which I'll talk about, and then the Mardi Gras Transportation System in the deepwater Gulf of Mexico. BP has played a major role and is part owner in all of those pipeline systems. And now BP is posturing itself to help deliver an Alaska gas pipeline, and hopefully that will go forward with time. In 1998, I was fortunate enough to be invited to be the project manager for the Caspian Pipeline. Fortunate in that this fulfilled a lot of my career ambitions of wanting to work in a foreign country and also wanting to manage a very large international project. It was a very high visibility, high profile project, and something that actually had never been done. Russia was opening up at the time and putting themselves in a position to allow foreign companies to come in and manage projects and do things in the former Soviet Union that had never been done, and they had never allowed foreign companies to come in and build a pipeline in their country. So the challenges were extremely immense, and I enjoyed challenges like that. Now, some would say I was unfortunate in that this was the most complex and one of the most contentious projects that you can ever imagine. There were 11 international oil companies that were owners in the system and three governments. And if you've ever tried to satisfy 14 stakeholders like that, you can imagine the complexities of trying to do something like that. Tim mentioned that the Caspian Pipeline, it starts at a huge oil field in western Kazakhstan called Tengiz, and it stretches across the top of the Caspian Sea and goes to the Black Sea, 935 miles. It was a 1.5 million barrel a day crude oil transportation system, and at the time cost about $2.6 billion. So it truly was a very, very large project. And it's, in a lot of ways, it's similar to a TAPS-sized pipeline. But the difference is the technical challenges that TAPS faced, they were actually very simple for CPC. The trade-off was the political issues, and they were immense, working with three governments and 11 international oil companies. For mega international pipeline projects, there's really, I'm going to group it into three major challenges, and I want to talk about each of those. The first major challenge are the political issues. The second part are the economic issues, and the third are the technical issues. And actually, the order of importance and the challenges to actually completing a project successfully are in that order. So let me start with the political issues. These are the most leveraging of the three. And by political, I'm referring to the associations of governments and stakeholders involving authority and power, because that's really what it's all about. Governments and stakeholders often use international pipeline projects as political levers. And by that, they provide a means of getting a valuable product to market. That's what they're for, either crude oil or natural gas. And countries use these to develop stature and status. They draw a tremendous interest from foreign governments, from investors, from companies that want to invest and build in the line, and from oil companies and gas companies that need to ship their products on the pipelines. Because of the size of these projects, economic development in turn provides autonomy and revenue for economic growth. And in a developing country, this is extremely important because it gives them a means to stimulate a large economic return, which provides economic development and more stability for the country, and particularly in smaller countries. And I want to illustrate the importance of just the political scene with giving you a couple of examples here. 2 years earlier, before I moved to Russia in 1998, I was sitting in a meeting at the Hyde Park Hotel in London, and there were over 20 oil and gas companies there representing their companies and trying to get a piece of the CPC pipeline. Chevron was the host of the meeting. They actually were the operator of the Tengiz field, which is where the pipeline originated. And they called all these companies together to decide who was going to invest in the project and who was going to actually make this thing happen and go forward. This was by far the most fascinating meeting I've ever been in my entire life. Over 3 days, representatives from each of the companies got to stand up in front of the group and explain why they should have an equity interest in this pipeline. Some of them took the position that they have oil and gas to ship, and so they should have a piece of the pipeline because they have products to move. Some of them took the position that they should have ownership in it because they were pipeline companies and they knew how to operate and build these pipelines. And there was one company there who actually took the position that they were entitled to own and operate the pipeline, and that's why they should be involved in the project. 3 days of this, some interesting discussions and trying to explain why this was important to you and why you should have a piece of it. And let me back up one step. The three governments that were involved had already staked that they would own 50% of the line, and so any of the investors had to not only pay their equity share, but they had to carry the governments. So they were going to have to pay double their equity share to make this thing happen. And we're talking about a $2.6 billion project. Now, how many of you would like to invest in something where you own half of it and you get to pay double? Well, after everybody stated their claim and had their say and why they should own it, Chevron asked for the percentage of interest that everyone wanted. They took a whiteboard and they actually wrote on the board how much percentage every company in there wanted. And when they totaled it up, it was over 200% subscribed. So people wanted more of it than was actually available. So what do you do? They called a break. during the break, Chevron decided how much everybody should get. They wrote it on the board, they reconvened the meeting, and they had it out there in front of everybody. This is what we think everyone should get, and only 7 of the 20 companies were listed. So now we spent the rest of the time hearing from those that weren't on the list argue for why they should be on the list and why they deserved an equity interest. And Chevron very politely listened to that, called the meeting to a close, no changes, and went on with it from there. So that's how it was decided. Now, some of those that didn't get participation actually partnered later with some of those that did get some involvement. So they ended up having 11 companies involved in the project. And they got to pay their share plus the government share in that. So just the dynamics of a meeting like that, trying to decide who's in and who's out, those are some of the issues that have to be dealt with because the stakes in a pipeline system are just extremely large. Let me refer to another example that's happened recently. It's been in the current affairs, and that was the, you can call it what you want, but the invasion of the country of Georgia by the Russian Federation recently. There's a lot of reasons for why that happened. You have to go back in history to understand what this was all about. But in 1991, when the former Soviet Union broke apart, a lot of the formerly independent countries wanted their independence back. They'd been under an iron rule of Russia for 70-plus years, and now they started looking at how can they establish themselves and be independent countries. One of the countries in Southeast Asia, or Central Asia, Azerbaijan, has oil. In fact, if you go back in history, the history of the oil business actually started in Azerbaijan. And they had tremendous wealth because of the oil there, and they had a way to develop their country, economic development and all through that. And Western companies, including BP, have played a big part in helping Azerbaijan develop as a country. Another one nearby, Georgia, the country of Georgia, doesn't have oil. And they actually don't have a lot to offer for economic development. So they look to partner with the West to provide some stability for them and a way for their country to grow and develop. The oil fields in Azerbaijan had to have an outlet for their crude oil, and BP and a number of other companies formed a group called the Azerbaijan International Oil Consortium to develop the fields there, and they started a pipeline project called BTC, Baku, Tbilisi-Ceyhan, and this is a 1,750-mile pipeline, 1+ million barrels a day, $4 billion project that goes from Baku, Azerbaijan, through Tbilisi, Georgia, and to a Turkish port called Ceyhan on the Mediterranean Sea. And that's how that oil is given out. Well, that's the first pipeline in the Caspian Sea area that totally bypasses Russia. And for countries like Azerbaijan and Georgia, former republics of the former Soviet Union, they were not happy about that because they lost some control and influence. And these countries now have a means of economic development from the money that comes off of a pipeline. And Russia did everything they could to stop that project from happening. But it did. It started up in 2005, and it's operating today, and it's producing oil, and they're looking at expanding it. Well, during this invasion of Georgia, you may have heard that some bombs were dropped on the pipelines. And we originally thought maybe they had bombed this BTC pipeline. Well, they didn't actually. They dropped them close to it on purpose, and we knew that, and they sent a message. Just because of the risk that was involved there, the line was shut down, and it was down for a couple of weeks, and it's now back and operating. But the message was clear what this was all about. We can do this when we want to, and if you're not nice to us and listen to us, we've got an option of doing something here. So again, on the political side, these are some of the things that big international pipelines mean to countries. They use them for political levers to make their cases, to state their points. And you have to really pay attention to that when you're trying to develop these projects, because those are the big issues that have to get resolved before you can move on to the next one. Now, the second big issue is the economic side of it. And when you think about the economic side of these, during the life of a project, there's different periods of it. During the design and construction, there's a lot of money spent off to contractors, to engineering firms, to supply firms to provide the materials and equipment to build a pipeline like this. After it starts up, the tariff revenue off for the owners of the pipeline is huge. The taxes are even larger to the governments and host governments. On the CPC pipeline, over the life of it, it will literally generate tens of billions of dollars in tax revenue to the governments of Russia and Kazakhstan. The BTC pipeline will actually generate over $100 billion of revenue over its life. So you imagine what that does to a country wanting a piece of that action and wanting a piece of that. These are money machines. They just are. And because of that, from the start of them, you've got a game going on between the shippers on the line who want to get their product to market and all of the stakeholders who want a piece of the action. And the game is trying to get the thing built, get the tax structure such, get the tariff structure set, so that you don't kill the project. And with everybody vying for a piece of it, numerous stakeholders, that's a huge challenge for those that are trying to ship their product to market. And that's what typically happens on these projects, is how do you balance the cost of the line with the tariff structure for those who are going to own and operate it with the taxes that the governments want out of that. And if that's not stable enough, the risk to the investors in the line is just enormous over the life of the project. And that's why you hear about needing stability on tax structures to make a project like this go. You change it later on after you start, and you can destroy the economic viability of a project like that. But it's too late. It's there. It's going to function. The product's got to get to market. But those that invest and take the risk are taking a huge risk if they don't know what the terms of the condition are. Think of you and your mortgage company. You want to take a mortgage out on your house. The banker comes to you and says, yeah, I'll loan you the money, but I'm not going to tell you what the interest is, and I'm not going to tell you what the payment terms are. I'm going to decide that as we go along. Is that okay with you? Would you like to invest in that? Well, I don't think many of us would. You need to know the terms of the deal. And you need to know what it's going to mean to you over the life of your mortgage before you're ready to sign up for something like that. And that's why that stability is extremely important to you. Let me move on to the last part, and that's the technical issues. These are actually the easiest ones. Most people think that the technical challenges you face, that's where you get a lot of attention because you can see machines and you can see pipe and you can see equipment and all that. Designing and building the line is actually the easy part. There are plenty of challenges to deal with, and I'm going to use the Trans-Alaska Pipeline as an example. That was an engineering marvel when it was built, and it still is today. And the time that it's been in service and operation has proved that the engineers that designed and built that thing did an absolutely incredible job. It has withstood earthquakes, and it's withstood over 30 years of product life, all the way up to 2.2 million barrels a day, down to today it's running about 750,000 barrels a day. There's been sections where they've had to replace it because of corrosion, because of slides, because of issues that have happened on the line. It's even been shot once. Somebody put a bullet in it one time. It's had numerous issues with it, but it's withstood the test of time, and it truly is an engineering marvel. But that's not the difficult part. Dealing with the soil conditions and the design conditions and all, engineers usually figure that out. One of the other challenges is the logistics. Getting pipe to remote locations, especially very large diameter, very, very heavy pipe, is a huge challenge. A lot of times on these projects, you have to actually build roads, build railroads, build storage facilities, loading terminals, sometimes docks and marine terminals, before you can ever actually start building the pipeline. On the BTC pipeline, there were over 100,000 truckloads of pipe, moving pipe around to get that done. And most of the line was in mountainous terrain with no roads whatsoever. And so just dealing with the logistics of getting all the equipment and materials to site to actually build a line like that is just a huge challenge. But again, those are the easy things relative to the economic and the political issues that have to be resolved. The other part I mentioned is the cost and the money that's involved. On BTC, there were over 140 million man-hours of work spent on that project. 140 million man-hours. Those are jobs for people building the line. CPC had over 50 million man-hours of work to build that. At one time, when I was doing the CPC project, we were spending over $5 million a day, which in today's dollars is probably $6 to $7, maybe even $8 million a day. Every day, spending that much money to get the line built. These large sums of money spent to do projects, it also draws an element of corruption that you have to be aware of. It's just, when you got a lot of money floating around like that, there's people that want it. And just trying to deal with the corruption side of it is an issue that has to be addressed and has to be dealt with. And so you're always looking for ways to protect yourself on that area too. Let me talk a bit about the Alaska Gas Pipeline. It's going to face all three of these categories of challenges. It's going to have its political issues. Fortunately, the governments of U.S. and Canada are friendly, and they get along. And so you may think that's going to be relatively easy. But some of the issues there are going to be land rights, native issues. There's a project called Mackenzie Delta Pipeline that the Canadians have been trying to get built for a long time to get gas out of the Mackenzie Delta area and bring it down to basically the same portion of Canada that the Alaska pipeline wants to go to, Alberta. And the reason they want to do that is because you can get it to Alberta, you can get it to anywhere in the lower 48 because the pipeline systems all connect up to Alberta. And so there's issues on whether Mackenzie Delta pipeline is going to get approved before the Alaska pipeline. That's a Canadian issue. But some of the owners of Alaska Gas have equity interest in Canada Gas. These issues have to get resolved before something's going to move ahead on an Alaska gas pipeline. On the economic side, who's going to pay for it? What's the tax structure going to be? What's the tariff structure going to be? Whose labor forces are going to build it? And which sections? Which engineering and supply companies are going to provide the equipment and materials for that? All that's got to get sorted out before that project's going to move forward. Now, there are teams there working on that, and they're trying to address all those issues. But those are some of the things that are happening. The design part, again, is going to be relatively easy compared to the political and economic issues that have to be resolved. But it will face all those challenges, and if you just watch the news, you can see those things, and they'll play out. And I believe they're going to be very fascinating to see what happens in those areas. But that's what it's going to take to move the project forward. Let me wrap up here and just tell you what happened on CPC. The line got built and started up in 2003, and today it's operating at 600,000 barrels a day. The economic plan for that whole project was to do an initial project and then expand it over a 12-year period to get it up to 1.5 million barrels. And the economic plan was developed on that. Four expansions had to happen to make this a successful project. Well, we got the first part built. We built the pipeline, we built four pumping stations, and we built a brand new marine terminal in Novorossiysk. And we started on the expansion project, which was supposed to happen 4 years later, which would have been 2007, and it's never happened. And you go back and look at what are the issues. Well, when the project started, it was during the Yeltsin era when Russia was relatively weak. That's when they invited a lot of foreign companies to come in and start providing some economics to move these projects forward. And they actually had to give up a lot of control to do that. Well, by the time it started up in 2003, Vladimir Putin had been elected president. The oil industry had completely turned around. They had money in the country, and their political ability to leverage the project had changed considerably. And so they started exerting their influence over it. They didn't like the original tariff structure. They didn't like the terms of the deal. They didn't like the taxes they were getting off of it, and they obviously didn't like the control of it. So they dug in and wouldn't let CPC move ahead until they got control over all those issues, and they're still wrangling over those. Now, Chevron and the other owners of the Tengiz field had already started their expansion project. They spent over $4 billion to expand Tengiz planning to put the additional production into the CPC pipeline, and it's ready to go today. But there's no pipeline to put it into. And because of that, Chevron's had to give up leverage on the tariff. They've had to give up control over the pipeline. They've had to slowly give up what they originally negotiated to do this deal to try to get the expansion project to happen. Today, they're shipping over 200,000 barrels a day on a railroad system that they had to build just to get the oil out of there. You can imagine that's not very economically attractive, but that's what they're doing to get the oil out. Eventually, when CPC gets approved to expand, it will expand, and all that oil will go into the pipeline. And that was what the whole plan was from the beginning. But I'll contend to you, it will never expand until Russia gets control of it the way they've wanted to. It is the only pipeline today in the whole Russian Federation that Transneft, the national pipeline company, does not own and operate. And until they get control of it, I predict it'll never get expanded. That's not an economic issue. The economics are there. They're clearly there to expand it and move it forward. It's not a technical issue. We did all the design work. It's ready to be expanded. It's political issues, and until those get resolved, it's not going to move forward. So when you think in terms of these big projects, think in terms of how all those things play out. And all of that has to fall into place before these big projects are going to happen. The stakes are enormous. It means too much to the governments that are involved in these. And a lot of times the oil companies are at the end of the line trying to deal in this games of settling the economic distribution on how these things get carried forward. So thank you for being here today. Thank you for listening to this and letting me share some of my experiences and some of the issues about large international pipeline projects.
You've been listening to the Vice President and Projects Director for BP Exploration Alaska, Gary Buble, recorded September 19, 2008 at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska. Following his speech entitled International Mega Pipeline Projects, Transportation System or Political Lever, he responded to questions from the audience. Compared to the CPC pipeline, why was the construction of the Trans-Alaska pipeline so much more expensive? Did Alaska's adverse environment contribute to the increased cost of the project? An audience member asked.
It's a good question because I've heard numbers for the Trans-Alaska pipeline of $8 billion. I've heard numbers like that. I don't know the exact cost, but it was considerably more, especially in the dollar terms, because that was in the 70s. And we're talking of pipelines that were built in the 2000s. There were a number of reasons. One was just the control over the project. If you remember, Trans-Alaska was delayed almost 3 years waiting on permits. So a lot of the investment was done. Pipes sat in a yard in Fairbanks for several years just waiting to get permits for that line. I think the technical conditions for the Trans-Alaska pipeline were considerably different. The permafrost conditions, which pipelines, hot oil pipelines, had not been built in those conditions before. And then the labor market's completely different. The cost of labor here in Alaska is considerably different than it would be in a third world foreign country like the two projects that I talked about. I'll tell you this, when I started on CPC, I can't tell you how many times I heard from the owners, we don't want the same thing to happen here that happened on the Trans-Alaska pipeline. That was in the back of everybody's mind. So there was a whole lot more rigor put into the control and the execution plan of that just to make sure something like that didn't happen. Because if it was going to increase by an order of magnitude, $2.6 billion, an order of magnitude would have been $26 billion. That just scared everybody, and they didn't want to see something like that happen.
Considering the recent backlash generated from the development of LNG along the Columbia River in Astoria, would you please speak to the potential for LNG somewhere along the American coastline? Another audience member asked.
I'll tell you what I know about it, and I don't know a whole lot about LNG because I don't work that. I do know LNG projects are extremely challenged versus natural gas pipelines. They're just extremely difficult to make economic. And a lot of it is because they're long-term projects, and getting the financial structure in place for them is just what I talked about. It's hard to get that nailed down so that you know how they'll compete against a pipeline long-term. The LNG terminals involve a number of things. First of all, you've got to gasify the liquid on one end. You've got to build huge, expensive ships to transport it, and then you've got to regasify it on the other end and get it to distribution pipeline systems. When you add all those elements up, they're economically very, very challenged to do. And so most places don't want to deal with the risk involved with the pressures and the temperatures and the potential dangers of an LNG system versus just natural gas pipelines, which are all over this country. And people know how to operate them, and they know what the risks are. And I think it's just a trade-off of those elements like that.
Next, an audience member asked Mr. Buble to reflect on the most valuable lessons learned from working on the CPC project in Russia.
Well, for those that are owners in Tengiz, I think, and BP is actually a part owner in Tengiz. We have 5% interest in Tengiz. The issue there is you think you've got a deal, and you may not have a deal long term. And that's what's happened. The game has been changed since the original deal from CPC. Now we knew those risks were there. And part of it was just the shape of the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union at the time. The deal was made in the Yeltsin era. And in our country, those would be legally binding agreements that were made. Russia has not necessarily stood by all of those agreements, and they're not extremely clear. There's always issues where it's gray on how they're being interpreted and how they're dealt with. But we thought we had a deal. The project was sanctioned on that deal. It wasn't completely firmed up, and I think the lesson learned is you better make sure you've got it landed as hard and fast as you can, and it's going to last the terms of the length of the project, or you're taking a huge risk to go into it. And I think that's the mistake. We didn't have a good enough deal that was going to stand the test of time, and with what's happened in the world since then.
What will happen if Russia gets control of the Caspian Pipeline Consortium, or CPC Pipeline?
I mean, that's a good question. A lot of people, you have to question what's going on in Russia today and why are they doing the things they're doing. And I'm not politically astute enough to answer that. I will say this. I firmly believe that as soon as Russia gets control of CPC, it will expand. The economics are clearly there, and they need more export capacity in the country. They're limited right now on how much they can export out of the country. And so they're having to consume a lot of the oil domestically, which they don't get a good return on that. So the companies that actually have oil, they want to get it out of the country. So there's a huge demand for additional export capacity. And CPC is one of the best pipeline systems in the whole country. It just is. And if they can get control of it and get the expansions approved, they can go from where it's 600,000 barrels a day up to 1.5 million barrels a day. They could do that in a 2.5 year period if they wanted to do that. And you get another million barrels a day on the world export market, and it just means huge revenues for those involved with that. And I think they'll do that if they ever get control of it.
Since we are so dependent on oil and the construction of these pipelines, how do you make sure there is enough oil to keep the pipeline full at all times? Another audience member asked.
Yeah, that's always a challenge to make sure there is enough there to keep it full, to generate the tariffs and pay back the revenue on it. In Russia, where we were with CPC, there was clearly enough oil there. I mean, we could identify the fields and do long-term production projections on those to say there was enough there. Tengiz fields in itself can keep the line over half full just by itself. It's a 13 billion barrel oil field. It's Prudhoe size that's there. And then there's another probably half a dozen multi-billion barrel fields in that area that are tying into CPC and eventually will be developed and provide production there. BTC in Azerbaijan, we're producing over 1 million barrels a day from offshore in Azerbaijan. We're basically keeping the line full ourselves today with the AIOC, Azerbaijan International Oil Consortium. And that was the economic basis of building that pipeline.
Last, an audience member asked Mr. Buble to share his personal perspective on the most interesting and challenging potential pipeline development projects likely to happen in the future.
I'm actually very happy to be here in Alaska, and I mean that completely. I think Alaska is one of the best places to be in BP today. Part of my team is working on a long-term renewal program for the North Slope. We plan to be here another 30 to 50 years. And we believe there's enough on the North Slope to last that long. And we're trying to put together a plan for another 30 years of development up there. And to me, that's exciting. That's why I came up here. And I'm really looking forward to that. I'd love to see the gas pipeline go forward. but there's heavy oil on the North Slope. There's still light oil to be developed. And for the rest of my career, I plan to be here and help make that happen. So that's what excites me, and that's what I enjoy doing.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents with Gary Bubel, Vice President and Projects Director for BP Exploration Alaska. He responded to questions from the audience following his speech entitled International Mega Pipeline Projects, Transportation System, or Political Lever, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on September 19, 2008. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show or share your comments with us and other listeners. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.